E.E. Cummings was born in 1894. Or to look at it another way, he was six in 1900, so he really was a child of the 20th century. He was one of the earliest of the American modernists. And in this mini lecture, I'm going to talk about him specifically as a pagan modernist. I've picked up that term from something which was said by Malcolm Cowley, a fellow writer and poet, a member of Cummings' generation, also a student at Harvard. And Cowley said this in an obituary which he published in 1962 when E.E. Cummings died. And he spoke about Cummings as part of a generation of Harvard writers. And he said, quote, "Almost all of them were pagans in the sense that they invoked Greek deities, especially goat-footed Pan, more often in their poems than they invoked Christian saints," unquote. And he also said that most of them, quote, "started as fleshly poets in revolt against Christian austerity." And in talking about Cummings as a pagan modernist, I'm going to look at three poems, the first of which is Sapphics, and the second two we would know by their first line. Most of Cummings' poetry he left untitled, so in general we refer to his poems by the first line of the text. And so the second poem I'm going to talk about is All in Green Went My Love Riding. And the third and last is God Gloats Upon Her Stunning Flesh Upon. And these three poems are also on a PDF, which you can download if you're listening to this lecture on the EFL audio site. You'll find the PDF is also there. These three poems will give us some perspective also on Cummings' relationship to form and to the breaking of form, which is something that we associate powerfully with the modernist movement. And they're also a perspective on his early poetic development at Harvard and then in the Great War. And they relate to the interests of my own work, and so they're for me a way of exploring what I find so magical about Cummings' poems. I came to Cummings first in study of his relationship to classical literature, Greek and Latin classical literature. And these poems, all three of them, have something to say about that. And then my more recent work on Cummings is a slice of life biography about his experience in the Great War. And the third of these poems reflects his transatlantic crossing when he took a boat from New York to France. And it's a poem about ocean and the experience of the vastness of ocean. The first two poems were written at Harvard, and at Harvard, Cummings found himself amongst a group of friends, several of whom would later become poets and writers and prose authors themselves. The one who became most famous is John Dos Passos, though others also became significant in the literary world, including Robert Hillier, whose poetry later won a Pulitzer Prize, and S. Foster Damon, who became the preeminent Blake scholar of his generation. Robert Hillier talked about this group of friends at Harvard and how they conceptualized themselves as divided into ancients and moderns, by which he meant that some of them looked to established and traditional forms, which they wanted to perfect, and others, the moderns, including Cummings, longed for that novelty, that change, looked to the exciting art that was coming out of Europe, visual art, cubism, as well as changes in the writing of poetry, which they followed via the little magazines. But even though modernism saw itself as breaking and hunting for the new, it developed in an environment with a very powerful relationship to 19th century poetry. And we see that in the first of the poems that I'm going to talk about, Sapphics. At Harvard, Cummings read a great deal of Keats, and these Keatsian ideas about youth and glory and beauty and truth and poetic immortality shaped his literary world and his literary aspirations. And he pours that into this poem, Sapphics, into a classical form. And I'll read the poem. Sapphics. When my life his pillar has raised to heaven, when my soul has bleeded and builded wonders, when my love of earth has begot fair poems, let me not linger. Ere my day be troubled of coming darkness, while the huge hall sky is elate with glory, let me rise and, making my salutation, stride into sunset. And what he's expressing here is an idea that the purpose of life or of his life is to create great and beautiful and true poetry. And when that's done, life is done. And he imbibes this idea from Keats, well, from Keats especially, and from Keats's poetic world. But as I say, Sapphics is written in a classical form. It's a specific form of 11 syllable lines, three lines of 11 syllables, followed by one line of five syllables. And in addition to the syllable count, it has a very specific meter. And you can hear that if I read in a slightly exaggerated form. When my life his pillar has raised to heaven, when my soul has bleeded and builded wonders. And then once you have that in your ear, you can hear it more naturally in an easier reading of the stanza. When my love of earth has begot fair poems, let me not linger. And something that this shows is the importance of form to Cummings early in his poetic life. And modernism for Cummings and free verse in his writing is not simply about discarding form, ignoring form, thinking that there are no rules. It's about fighting back against form, breaking form, using meter but contorting it, pushing it to the edges of what is recognizable. And so actually early in Cummings' poetry, he was writing in some very traditional forms, which he loved playing with. And then gradually he starts to fight back more and more against that. Sapphic meter is not an easy meter to use in English because it often comes across as unnatural, and so it's difficult to write sapphic stanzas that don't sound forced or excessively contrived. Cummings' sapphics are well executed, and they show, therefore, his agility with the English language at this point, but they are also essentially juvenilia, and what they tell us most about is the environment of Cummings' very early poetic development. His world in Harvard, where he was studying Greek and English literature, his love of complex form, and this world of Keatsian romanticism, which he imbibed. The next poem that I want to turn to, by contrast, is one of Cummings' most enduring poems, and I'll read it before talking a little bit about it. All in green went my love riding on a great horse of gold into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling. The merry deer ran before. Fleeter be they than dappled dreams, the swift, sweet deer, the red, rare deer. Four red roebuck at white water, the cruel bugle sang before. Horn at hip went my love riding, riding the echo down into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling, the level meadows ran before. Softer be they than slippered sleep, the lean, lithe deer, the fleet-flown deer. Four fleet does at a gold valley, the famished arrow sang before. Bow at belt went my love riding, riding the mountain down into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling, the sheer peaks ran before. Paler be they than daunting death, the sleek slim deer, the tall tense deer. Four tall stags at a green mountain, the lucky hunter sang before. All in green went my love riding, on a great horse of gold, into the silver dawn. Four lean hounds crouched low and smiling, my heart fell dead before. And this poem also raises questions of classicism and medievalism and romanticism, because there's been a great deal of debate among scholars about whether we ought to read All in Green What My Love Riding as showing the presence of a medieval hunt, especially perhaps medieval hunts as reimagined in romantic poetry, or should we perceive echoes of the classical hunt, including the hunting activities of Diana or Artemis, the classical goddess of the hunt. Another thing that scholars have disagreed about is the reading of gender in this poem. Are we looking at a male speaker speaking about a female beloved, or a female speaker speaking about a male beloved? One scholar reading this poem, Thomas Frisch, has made some important points, arguing that there is ambiguity of gender built into the text of the poem itself and that we shouldn't attempt to simplify or resolve that. He points in particular to the fact that the deer appear to shift in gender throughout the poem. They appear as roebuck, then as does, then as stags. But another thing which I find very striking about this poem from the gender perspective is that Cummings placed it as the fifth among nine poems which he collected in the subsection Songs in his first collection of poetry. And these nine songs are closely interwoven. They reuse themes, they echo each other's language, they even rework certain snippets of language from poem to poem and reuse imagery. So it is a very tightly interwoven section. And in this section overall, we appear to have a speaker who is implicitly gendered as male and a beloved who is at points explicitly gendered as female. So I found it actually all the more surprising in my own archival research when I saw the manuscript drafts of Olin Green Went My Love Riding and discovered that actually in the very earliest drafts, the beloved is very explicitly gendered as male. It is my lord who goes out riding, and there's a reference to his spurs. So in a sense, there's a contradiction between the textual development of this poem in manuscript draft and the textual presentation of this poem as the fifth among nine songs, which collectively appear to have a male speaker and a female beloved. Of course, a reader only encounters the text in its published form and doesn't have access to the manuscripts. But I think that there is an instability of gender here, which lurks within the poem and within its text, and which I think readers respond to. I think part of what readers intuitively find exciting about this poem is the instability of gender. And the last thing that I want to say about this poem is that it shows us something further about Cummings' relationship to form and structure. Because here we see Cummings' inventiveness and his structural instincts. He's creating a rhythm for the reader based on rider, hounds, deer in a certain rotation. And also, again, if you go back to the manuscript drafts, you can see how schematic his thinking was. Actually, in the earliest drafts, there is a color scheme of silver, green, and gold. And that structures the whole text, even before he had very much at all of the surrounding language. But in some ways, I would say this poem is still a safe poem. It's still intelligible within the world that his Harvard professors knew and approved of. It was the kind of literature that they could like. And some of what Cummings had to do in his own poetic growth was to discard his professors' approval and write in a way which they frankly didn't understand. And the final poem that I want to turn to, the third of the three, is one of the most daring of the early poems that Cummings wrote. It's a sonnet, it's in a very broken form, and it takes on the vastness and the chaos and the insanity of ocean in, I think, an incredibly powerful way. So next I'll read this broken sonnet. God gloats upon her stunning flesh, upon the reachings of her green body among unseen things, things obscene, whose fingers young the caving ages curiously con. The lunge of her hunger softly flung over the gasping shores leaves his smile wan, and his blood stopped tears in the frail anon, the shovings and the lovings of her tongue. God is the sea, all terrors of his being quake before this its hideous work most old, whose battening gesture prophesies a freeing of ghostly chaos in this dangerous night. Through moaned space God worships God, behold, where chaste stars writhe captured in brightening fright. The first point which might just be useful in reading this poem is that the meaning of con here is archaic, to learn about, to become familiar with, to get to know. So, whose fingers young the caving ages curiously con, speaks of time, eternity, coming to have knowledge of ocean. And the second point I would make is that if you're looking at it on the page, you'll see that the spacing is non-standard, but it is actually in two quatrains followed by a sestet. And the quatrains rhyme. So upon, among, young, con, flung, won, anon, tongue. And the final sestet also rhymes on a slightly more unusual pattern. So that's being, old, freeing, night, behold, fright. And this poem also makes use of the Petrarchan turn, which is that moment in a Petrarchan sonnet after the first eight lines where the poem shifts in tone or focus. And here Cummings uses that to introduce the sea. It's the first time actually that the sea is named. So up to that point, the reader is wondering who actually is being described here as having a green body hiding things which are invisible and obscene and yet attracting the lust of God. Also, if you're looking at it on the page, you'll see that her is capitalized, as is the second occurrence of God in the phrase God worships God. And in a sense, that appearance of capital letters evokes something of the Christian tradition of God. But underneath that, I think, is much more fundamentally a deep paganism. Because after all, it is in the old pagan cosmogonies where we have earth, sea, sky, sun embodied as gods and goddesses, and where these deities also take each other as lovers and procreate and bring forth further divine offspring. I spoke a moment ago about the setting of All in Green, Wet My Love Riding in Cummings' first collection of poetry and how that might affect the way that we engage with the text. And this sonnet, God Gloats, appears in a section of sonnets which are grouped as unrealities. Cummings grouped his sonnets as realities, unrealities, and actualities. So this one appears in unrealities. And the section on realities opens with a poem which sets a kind of ethereal tone with notes of roses and perfume and music and twilight and a dream world. But then, if you look throughout that section, I would say that the keynote of unrealities as a group of poems is that it is exploring the relationship between love and time and death. And this poem, this sonnet, I think has a wildness about it. It comes, as I mentioned earlier, out of Cummings crossing, his transatlantic crossing from New York to France. But actually, it developed slowly. And in France, he served for 3 months as an ambulance driver in the Great War. And then he was arrested, most unjustly, and imprisoned. And I think in that prison, he came to have a fundamentally different relationship with enclosed spaces and the vastness of seemingly infinite spaces, and some of the emotional charge of being confined in a very brutal and very sadistic prison for 3 months in a very cold winter on starvation rations, I think is poured into this poem. And I think that's some of the power and some of the almost craziness in this poem. There's a wildness in this poem that verges on insanity. But then I think part of what Cummings is capturing is that to comprehend the vastness of ocean, of time, of night, of the cosmos, it isn't really within human comprehension. And therefore, it doesn't actually lie entirely within our sanity. So to capture it in art, when it doesn't fall within human sanity or human comprehension, is an incredible achievement. And it speaks to the note that I want to end on, which is what was most fundamental to Cummings in his understanding of art and what art was and what art was doing. For him, art was about movement, it was about life, it was about chaos, it was about the verb, because the verb moves and does. And it was not about the noun, it was not about stasis or standing still. And yet, it is the condition of art that, because it is a product, whether it's a painting or a text, it freezes chaos, it stops movement, it freezes the movement of the verb. And that, for him, was the fundamental paradox of art. How can you freeze chaos and still be alive? So, I would leave you on the thought that God Gloats is an incredible and underestimated poem. in which we can see the insanity of freezing chaos.